From London, it's the Wired.co.uk podcast. It's episode 34 for Friday, the 15th of July, 2011. On the show this week, we join Moby on the set of his new music video to discuss his adoration for vintage drum machines, his iPad and electric kettles, as we put your questions to him in person. We'll also speak to the woman behind the world's first robot film festival, Heather Knight, and learn exactly what a robot film festival is. And can you tell what this is the sound of? No idea? We'll tell you all about the terrifying, rubbery mechanical lips that produce that noise later on, as we spread our lips around this week's whale steak of a podcast. Seasoned greetings, I'm Nate Langson, and I'm the editor of Wired.co.uk, and joining me on the Wired rooftop today, Associate Editor Olivia underscore Solon.
Hello.
How are you doing?
I'm very well, thank you.
Good. Liv got the giggles a few minutes ago because of my intro. Apparently it was just too funny for her to stomach.
Well, you said spread our lips around this week's whale steak of a podcast.
What's wrong with that?
What's not wrong with that?
Don't know. Well, anyway, we've got no Duncan this week because he is at the Latitude Festival. Last week, I was at the Sonosphere Festival. That's why I had a podcast early. Liv, why aren't you at a festival?
I don't know. Maybe I should just head off and leave you to it.
What's wrong with you? Well, anyway, on the topic of music, though, you did something pretty cool yesterday afternoon. You went and met Moby.
I did. Moby's here to film the latest music video for his single Lie Down in Darkness from his album Destroyed, and I met with him at his hotel room, and we had a lovely discussion about all sorts of things, and he had some advice to give to new musicians as well.
Right, well, let's take a step back in time in our Wired time machine and have a listen to what he had to say.
From our Facebook and Twitter followers, who we asked today what if they could have one question to ask you, what that would be. So apologies in advance to some of them. The first question is from Adrian Lita, and he said, if you had one tip to give an emerging band today, what would it be?
My one tip would be to learn how to do as many things as possible. Because the way the music business has changed and continues to change, you can't just do one thing anymore. Like, I think in the 50s, 60s, 70s, like, you could get by just being a bass player. You could get by just being a singer. And now, the only way I think for a musician to have a viable career is to know how to do everything. You know, so a musician should know how to write songs and play instruments and perform live and DJ and remix and do production and write classical music for films and like just know how to do everything. And there's a good chance that for the next 40 or 50 years, you'll actually be able to have a good living as a musician.
Second question is from Camilla Glad, and she says, what's your favorite app?
My favorite app, I wish I had a better answer. I don't know if it's necessarily even my favorite, because it's not based on like any magical functionality it has, but it's the Scrabble app.
Okay.
I use it 90% of the time if my iPad is on. That's what I'm just sitting in an airport playing Scrabble. So although I really love the Mulletizer.
Okay.
The Mulletizer, like, so it's a toss-up between the Scrabble app and the Mulletizer.
Good. Liam Daly asks, what's your favorite gadget?
My favorite gadget? There's so many good ones. And any answer I have, like, the obvious answer is my iPad. Because it really is just like, I remember when I first got my iPad, and this is a sad thing to say, but maybe some people will relate to this, I had an emotional connection with my iPad that I've never had with another piece of technology. And I think because it's tactile and it works so much better than it should. Like, it just, I remember first turning it on and expecting it to be okay. And it so far surpassed my expectations. So being a cliche, my favorite gadget would be my iPad. If I wasn't allowed to pick my iPad, I would probably pick an electric kettle, because that,
a lot of tea.
The fact that you can make tea in 30 seconds is still kind of miraculous to me.
This is from Stuart Wood. What is the most entertaining thing that people shout at you in the street?
I have nothing against Eminem, but there was a period where we had this strange feud that I didn't understand, because it seemed like he was more feuding with me than I was with him. But the neighborhood where I lived in New York in the Lower East Side was very Latino and very African American. And so I'd walk through my neighborhood and all the little homeboys in my neighborhood would always yell out very derogatory things about Eminem. And they would always make sure that I knew that they had my back. So if Eminem and his D12 posse ever came to the Lower East Side, the Latino and African-American homeboys, they all wanted to let me know that, like, you know, they knew I'd been in the neighborhood for a while, so they had my back.
Okay, so Ivan Flores has asked, what's your biggest fear when composing music?
It's a very good question. I don't have a good answer, because I don't think I have... I have concerns when I'm working on music, like concerns that the song I'm working on won't be good, concerns that or it'll be a good song and I won't have the technical know-how to fully execute it. But as far as fears, maybe if I were healthier and more well-adjusted, I would have some rational fears, but I don't have any.
Mac West asked, are there any emerging genres of electronic music that particularly appeal to you?
I don't know if it's an emerging genre, but the broad world of ambient electronic music, sort of like electronic soundscapes, because it serves such a fantastic role in my life. You know, being able to put on music that's very undemanding, and it just becomes a soundtrack for daily life. And with especially with a lot of the sort of software platforms that exist, what I'm excited about is the idea of songs or ambient compositions that could be hours long. That would be an interesting app, is where someone could like make their own ambient track and it could just go on endlessly.
Jay Gunson asked, how's your collection of vintage drum machines and synths coming along, and have you used them in your recent material?
Yeah, I presumptuously maintain that I have the world's largest collection of antique drum machines, and I use them all the time. Like on the new album Destroyed, almost every song involves some old drum machine, just because I have a weird, irrational love for old technology. And there are a lot of people who collect old synths, so I can't compete in that world. But there are very few people who collect old drum machines. Like, I basically think it's me, Martin Gore, and some guy in Japan.
Final question, which is really asking us by a number of very uninspired people, including Gordon Stribling and James Warnett. Why does my heart feel so bad?
I guess it's up to each individual. You know, right now I feel fine, so I'm probably the wrong person to ask. You know, I just spent a nice day making a nerdy science fiction video and we're having a nice conversation. When we're done talking, I get to go out and have lunch. So ask me again tomorrow and I might have a much better answer, but for now, things are pretty good.
Excellent. Well, Moby, thank you very much for your time.
Oh, my pleasure.
It's been really great.
Awesome. Thanks, Moby. And thanks, Liv. That was pretty cool.
It was. He was a lovely man.
And he's got a new album out, hasn't he, now?
Yeah, his album is Destroyed, and it's come out with this photo book as well that accompanies it with all these images from his touring. And yeah, he's also performing at the iTunes Festival at the end of the month.
Ah, excellent. So I don't know if you can go. I think you can stream it. Yeah. Cool. Okay, well, let's get on with some news. It seems the Bad News Bears are having a picnic and Rupert Murdoch's the only guest. News of the World, a week ago, closed down in light of the hacking scandal, which we've covered at quite some extent on the website. And we're not going to cover in too much detail here because probably most people who are listening already know quite a lot about it. But an interesting development today is that the CEO of News International... whose name is
Rebecca Brooks.
Yep, I had Brooks on my. I couldn't remember.
She's
if it was,
the other bear at the grizzly bear picnic that you.
I think
mentioned.
It was the Bad News Bears.
Oh, the Bad News Bears.
Bad News Bears picnic. She has stepped down. She's been with News International for 22 years and was the editor of the News of the World. I think at the time that this hacking took place.
Yeah, she was.
And she has stepped down and posted her resignation. Today,
200 people lost their jobs when the News of the World closed last weekend, and she was seemingly the only person who wasn't really held to account. And I think it was going to have to happen sooner or later. And there was baying, the media were baying for her blood. And I think this has hopefully drawn a line under it.
Well, one of the other things that has had a line drawn under it is Rupert Murdoch's bid to take over the remaining part of B Sky B that his company doesn't already own, which I think is 60-something percent. He'd been bidding to take over the remaining percentages that he didn't already own. And it was sort of discussed that he may not be the fit and proper owner for the entire company and has withdrawn his bid.
Yeah.
Which kind of a lot of people seem to expect in light of everything that's been going on recently. But he has actually followed through with that.
Yeah, I mean, this came particularly after the news or the allegations that Gordon Brown had his phone hacked and the medical records of his son accessed by the newspapers of News International. And I think that caused a lot of ruckus in Parliament. And as such, he then withdrew the bid.
It's pretty crazy. The last news of the world, I think, was on Sunday, just gone.
Yeah.
And sold, I think you said, over 4 million copies.
Apparently about 4.5 million copies. And given that it usually sells about 2.6 million, or lately it's been selling about 2.6 million, it's pretty impressive. And with no ads either.
Yeah. They dedicated it, I think, a lot to talking about themselves.
Yeah. I was kind of hoping that they'd have all these stories that they've been sitting on, which they generally do. They sit on these stories, you know, either against footballers or big celebrities or their fake shake exposés. And I hope they've been sitting on them and they were just going to whack them all out in one go. But instead, it was fairly self-referential and a kind of more of a kind of eulogy. Is that the right word? For the newspaper, which was less interesting. But
well, it's a paper that's been on sale for almost 140 years, you know. So, yeah. Which I you sometimes forget
168
this.
168 years.
168 years.
Yeah.
Blimey. You kind of forget how old some of these papers are.
And it did do things before it exposed the, you know, sexual liaisons of footballers. There were, you know, it has done a lot of campaigning and a lot of broken major stories in its lifetime.
Well, the rumours are now that The Sun is going to become a 7-day paper as a result of all this. There's not been any confirmation, I don't think.
No, and I think they'll have to leave it for a while before they whack The Sun on Sunday out. So I think it will be a little bit transparent to everybody.
Sun on Sunday would be quite an interesting name, actually, for that paper.
I mean, that's essentially what the News of the World is, so it shouldn't make too much difference.
Well, we've got plenty of coverage of all this on the website. If you do a search for News International or News of the World or any of these things, you'll find all of the stories we've talked about. We're going to move on to some bit more positive news. Spotify, the darling love child of the European music scene, has finally launched in America, and Americans seem to be pretty pleased with it. Spotify's been going for about 3 years, I think, 3.5 years, something like that.
Yeah, and for the last 2 years, there's been talks that it's going to be launched in the US as well, but issues with the record labels has kind of hindered matters. But they've completed another round of funding in the end of June, and I believe that they've used some of that funding to, let's say, placate the record labels a little bit.
Well, they've launched with all four major labels in the United States, along with a whole raft of indie labels. And at the moment, it's a free service if you have an invitation. And if you don't have an invitation and want to get involved on day one, then you can pay, which makes a lot of sense. The invitations keep the buzz going, keep people talking about it. Have you got an invite? Have you not got an invite?
Yeah.
And if you just want to skip all that, you can pay.
Yeah.
It's genius. In fact, you didn't have that when it started over here. It was a free service only. You couldn't pay to begin with.
But then they obviously fine-tuned it over here and now are unleashing it over there.
Yeah. Well, if anyone wants an invitation who's listening in the US and hasn't got one already, if you search Spotify invite on why.co.uk, you'll find a blog that I wrote because I had a load of invites. I've been sitting in my account for months and months and months that I've been giving away to people who amuse me in the comments.
Yeah, one of the best. Who's amused you the most so far?
Well, someone said they wanted to name their next potato after me. I mean, I was hard-pressed not to give him all of my invites.
Yeah, I don't see why he didn't.
Okay, let's move on. There is a new plane that's going to fly twice as fast as Concorde and do the journey from Paris to New York in 2 hours in 10 years' time. That's pretty amazing.
This is awesome. This is the brainchild of a guy called Richard Lugg, who's a British aeronautical engineer who's got a heritage of working with Boeing and NASA, etc. He's come up with this idea of this plane, which would go maximum cruise speed of max 3.6 and a range of 6,000 nautical miles.
And it will fly at 60,000 feet, which is such a height, an altitude, that while you're looking out of the window, flying from Paris to New York in 2 hours, you can see the curvature of the Earth out of your window. That's pretty amazing.
That is pretty amazing. But we're not going to be seeing it, we're not going to be flying around in it anytime soon, are we?
No, it's, well, they hope that it will launch into the skies by June 2021. So 10 years, just under 10 years away. And generally with these things, although they have every good intention of launching, they do generally run into unexpected expenses and delays down the line. So yeah. I wouldn't say it's time to start holding your breath. But it's an amazing project. And apparently the key to this is the development of a new engine. Now, I am not an aerospace technician. I do not have a degree in rocket science. So we spoke to the CEO of Hypermac, which is a company that is developing this plane, which I don't think we've even named. It's called the Hyper... What's
it's called? It's called the Sonic Star.
The Sonic Star, not the Hyperstar. We spoke to him, Richard H. Lugg, to find out exactly how this engine differs and what makes it so interesting. Just have a quick listen to this.
The engine doesn't have any drive shafts or what we call spools in our business, which is that's been kind of the fault in the design for all jet engines since 1945, as we see it. And so what we did is that, you know, all the parts in the engine, they need to rotate, you know, to compress air and combust fuel and to generate thrust. So we remove the drive shaft and we propel all the turbo machinery, all the components electrically. And we generate electric power in the thrust part of the engine in the turbine.
I won't pretend I understand a great deal of what was just said.
Smile and nod.
Here's hoping that we get this by 2021. Well, moving back down to Earth for a little bit, Apple has made some changes to its App Store pricing policy.
It has. Apple has recalibrated its international prices for all its different apps to better match the price of the US dollar, the current price. When they first launched the App Store internationally, they benchmarked all the prices against the US dollar, but obviously there have been serious fluctuations in the valuation of the currency since then. So from now on, in the UK, apps that were worth 59p, did cost 59p, are now going to cost 69p. But if you think in Australia, the same Angry Birds, for example, has dropped from $1.19 to 99p.
So it's not necessarily good news or bad news. It's just that the international pricing have been changed and some people benefit and some people benefit less or have to pay more. Now, to put this into context, the App Store, as you said, opened in business in 2008 at a time when the dollar was worth about 50p. Today, a dollar's worth about 62p. And the fact that the prices of the apps haven't changed since that time is kind of not really accurate. Yeah. And it's not necessarily been that fair to developers who maybe think we're getting shafted a little bit by not earning what we could earn if the prices were accurate.
Yeah, and I think it's kind of important they have to jump up in these 10p or whatever it is increments. You can't really start having apps of 63p or, you know, it kind of makes sense. And I don't think anyone really is that bothered about a 10p difference.
I don't think they're going to be bothered about a 10p difference. I certainly wouldn't be, but like you say, 59p to 69p is not that much difference, but you move a few quid up and a $3.99 app is now going to cost $4.99. And when you think about the differences at the sort of 50, 60, 70 pound levels of apps, which there aren't that many, but there are, you know, there are a few, they could be significantly more expensive.
There are apps worth 50, 60, 70 pounds.
Oh, yeah.
What are they?
There are apps worth hundreds of pounds.
What do they do?
TomTom makes a navigation app, for example.
Yeah, that makes sense.
The Wolfram Alpha app, when it first came out, I forget how much it was, but it was dozens and dozens of pounds.
Oh, wow.
It's now a lot cheaper.
But, you know, 70% of that money should be going to the developers, so...
That's right, yeah. So developers will earn more from this, or less, if the prices have gone down.
Well, yeah, true.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to find out what that weird noise was at the beginning of the show.
Registration for the Wired 2011 Summit is now open. Don't miss your chance to hear some of the most inspiring talks from thought leaders of the Wired world over 2 days this October in London. For more information, please visit wiredevent.co.uk.
So I promised that we're going to tell you what that bizarre noise was, but we're actually going to make you wait a couple of minutes longer because first, Liv, you wrote a really interesting story earlier in this week about a city in Spain that is letting people swap their cars for train tickets.
Yeah, there's the city of Murcia, I'll pronounce it correctly, launched an initiative that allows people to trade in their old cars and in return they'll get given a travel pass for the rest of their life, a free travel pass.
Is that the same as just selling your car and keeping all the money you get from it and just spending it all on rail?
Well, yes, in a way, but it depends. I mean, if you give up your car when you're 20, a travel pass until the end of your life is going to be worth a significant amount more. And you can give in a car that's, you know, just as long as it's roadworthy, it's past its MOT equivalent, you can give in any old car. So, I mean, the point is to get some of the cars off the roads in this kind of congested city. But it's kind of an interesting initiative. I think it's something that could be replicated elsewhere.
Do you think it would take off over here?
I think it could do. I doubt it would be done. I think travel over here is probably much more valuable than cars in some ways, especially in London. But I think initiatives like this should be introduced.
I think there's the risk, though, that if you trade it in your car and then 6 months later, say, you have to move out of the city because maybe your partner had to move for work or something, or your kids needed a different school, then you're thinking, well, you know, I wish I hadn't sold my car and swapped it for this Oyster car.
Yeah, true. But then maybe it should be a kind of, you know, maybe there's some national initiative. I don't know. It's not, the transport systems aren't connected enough to allow that. But I think it's an interesting idea and worth exploring.
Definitely. Well, I would swap my brother's car for a train ticket. I don't have a car. I can't drive.
Any old train ticket.
Okay, we've got one more quick story just to go through before we get to our Robot Film Festival feature. At the start of the show, we played you this sound. Now, what this sound is, believe it or not, is a robotic pair of lips made out of a synthetic material singing a Japanese playground song. The kind of squeaky metallic piston sounds that you can hear as well are these, well, they are actually pistons, and they are manipulating this kind of lengthy, sort of like a foot long
rubbery tube
with these fake lips on the end. And in these pistons are sort of manipulating it so air passes through it.
Yeah.
And the idea,
it has a nose as well.
Oh, it does have a nose. Yeah. And the idea is that it is more accurately synthesizing the human voice.
Yeah. Now, I'm inclined to disagree with that suggestion. From the sounds of it, I mean, you can't, it doesn't clearly distinguish each of the words. But I guess you do get that kind of nasal
well, you know,
wind sound.
But let's be fair to this pair of rubber lips. It is singing in a different language.
That's true. But even in a different language, you can tell that there's not the crisp consonants and vowels that you are accustomed to hear.
True. Not to belittle the efforts of the professor who created this, a Hideyuki Sawada, who is from the Tokyo University. I actually don't have the exact university in front of me. Mm. He created this, and the video is well worth watching, even for the just disturbing factors alone.
Yeah.
It's the weirdest thing to watch. It scared the hell out of me. It kind of reminded me of the, do you remember that big dog? The big dog machine that could sort of walk on ice and slip over.
Yeah,
In the same way that was incredibly creepy.
Yeah.
From, do you remember who made that?
I can't remember. Oh,
I remember. It was the Boston Dynamics. They made it. They made this crazy giant robot that could carry huge payloads across really dangerous surfaces.
Yeah.
And it was the weirdest thing to watch. Again, if you've not seen that video, Google Boston Dynamics Big Dog, and it is the creepiest video you'll ever see. But before you do that, go on wire.co.uk and Google terrifying robotic mouth. And you'll find this one.
Yeah, I think one of our commenters on Twitter actually said it looks like one of those fake vaginas, which...
Yeah, true. There is an element of that. In fact, it reminds me of that birthing robot that we discussed on a previous robot that you went to see. Only that one didn't sing. Well, anyway, before we delve into the realms of madness and explicit podcasting, we are going to leave the news behind and move on to our second feature of this week. Katie Scott, our regular features contributor here, interviewed Heather Knight, who is the creator of the Robot Film Festival. This film festival starts, I think, in New York this weekend, and we couldn't let it go by without finding out what the hell a Robot Film Festival is. So we're going to hand over to Katie.
This is Katie for wire.co.uk, and I'm speaking to Heather Knight, who is coordinating the world's first Robot Film Festival. Thanks ever so much for joining me, Heather.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So can you tell me a bit more about the festival?
Sure. So this is the first, to my knowledge, robot film festival, but it's definitely the first ever robot Oscars party. We've started a robot Botskirt, so it's a short film festival. We've had over 70 submissions. About 50 will be shown at the festival. There's stuff from the research world. There's stuff from filmmakers, from motion graphics, anything that includes a robot as a character, real or fictional. We're really interested in exploring the future with robots, analyzing the present, and just kind of leveraging entertainment and the creativity of the whole performance industry to think about new technologies and think about where we're going in our technological future.
Where did the idea come about from?
I have a robot theater company in New York City called Marilyn Monroe Robot, and I've been basically trying to intersect the theater world with the robotics world because I study social robotics. So I study robots that can interact with people in our everyday lives, and there's a lot of really interesting social skills and social conventions that you encounter when you start designing robots for everyday spaces, like even sharing space, navigating a hallway, or just in maintaining an interaction over time, not just like a single interaction in a more museum or the secretary saying hello in a building kind of setting, but like where you're seeing this robot or working with this robot every day, not necessarily as a colleague, but maybe. I'm really interested in social design, and I wanted to leverage the sort of multi-millennial history of the theater industry and thinking about what gesture means and what interaction means and how you can maintain engagement and how you can please an audience. And so I started innovating stage-based technologies for how you could have a stand-up comedian on stage that's responding in real time to a audience. Anyway, on the path to creating this intersection between performance and robotics, we came up with this idea that if we could use filmmaking, then that's like you can take multiple takes and you can really just focus on the story and still leverage this sort of collaborative space between art and technology. So I want to create an interdisciplinary community. So that's how it came up. And films are great because you can take multiple takes and it's a little bit more forgiving than real-time theater.
I'm sure. And what sort of submissions have you got?
Our submissions are all over the place. They're really fun. It's not so much informational about robot research videos, although there are a couple of research videos that have entertainment value. The theme is storytelling with robots or celebrating robot culture.
is it an attempt to make robots seem a bit friendlier, perhaps?
It's not so much an attempt as kind of a reaction, but I mean there's a like the world of Hollywood robots and the world of actual what people research that people are working on and what people dream about is very different. And I definitely think robots have a bad rap, and I know that just looking at just the difference between the way certain like Asian cultures like Japan think about robotics and the way certain Western cultures think about robotics, that our relationship with kind of mythology and culture totally influences our expectations of technology. And so I think it's really important to have positive storytelling to create good technology. If you only tell stories about war robots, then we're only going to make war robots. Or we're going to make more robots than we otherwise would, because you don't think of what's possible until you can imagine it. And storytelling is a great way of imagining what's possible.
Of course. So you have your submissions. So what will actually happen this weekend?
There's a lot. There's the screenings of the accepted films. There's about 50. We're opening with a Spike Jonze short, I'm Here, on Saturday midday. And then in the evening, we have a red carpet Botsker Awards ceremony. So interspersed throughout the entire day, there's different robot human performers or technology and human performers. We have Jilted, a girl who got sick of people not showing up at her band practices and decided to make virtual characters of herself as her backup singers. We have Robot Cowboy, this guy that performs with the live monitor playing pictures across his pixelated face. It's kind of like an iMac on his head. We have I'm doing a collaboration with Reggie Watts, a really awesome Brooklyn-based comedian, where he's kind of representing the internal voice of my robot who's doing sort of a tribal dance on stage. So we've got performances, we've got the movies, we've got this red carpet award ceremony. We really want to create a community. There's art installations, there's great community around technology and art in New York City. So we're putting some of that stuff on display. And then Sunday is our summer camp. You get to make your own film, like in this sort of 3.5 hour, really like rapid fire workshop that will also be all online. A lot of our films will all be on Vimeo afterwards. Everything that we have permission to post, we will collect and collate on our Robot Film Festival account. And and then everything finishes with a big old barbecue.
Fantastic. But coming back to the actual awards themselves, the Botska's Awards, could you tell me a little bit about them? Because I understand the actual making of the awards that people receive was slightly unusual.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, that's definitely pretty exciting. So we thought it would be cool to have, if we're going to have robot Oscars, we might as well make them with robots. So we, our icon for the festival is Retro, this sort of childlike, reflective robot thinking about what it means to be a robot and what's he going to grow up to be. But so we have Retro 3D printed and like this really high resolution 3D printer, ABS plastic. So he's sitting there. There'll be a light bulb that will hopefully light. we're still working on that. Still like 3 days to go. And then the base is milled, robotically milled with the title of their award. So it's a robot award made by robots, the 3D printer and the robot mill.
And how many lucky people will go away with an award?
There are 9 Botskers this year.
And is it likely that the Botskers, the awards can move to another country in future years?
We'll see what happens. I mean, there's a massive interest in making the festival traveling. One concept that we're having is having still keeping the main annual festival in New York, but perhaps having more like one-day festivals in other places, more like an evening activity. Because what's great is about by going through this process of choosing the award-winning films, then we'll have this core of great robot films that our illustrious jury has said put the stamp of approval. So we can use that as a core of a traveling event that could then allow people to create community and participate and show off their own live robots in different spaces around the country or around the world.
Fantastic. So the festival's taking place this weekend, so the 16th and 17th of July. Heather, where can people find out more information about it?
Sure. Well, we post updates really frequently at Robot Film Fest on Twitter, and our website is robotfilmfestival.com.
Fantastic. And I just wanted to add at this point that you're coming over to the UK to speak at WIRD Summit in October.
Yeah, very exciting.
So we're looking forward to that. More details about that, as well as pictures of the Botska Awards. If you want to see those, visit WIRD.co.uk. Heather, thank you ever so much for your time, and I really hope it goes well this weekend.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Cool. Thanks, Katie. And thank you very much, Heather. Looking forward to hearing her speak at the conference. In fact, if anyone wants to come to the WIRD Summit, go to our website and have a look on the homepage. There's a link on it. That's the end of our podcast, Liv.
It is.
That's it.
It's a sad day.
We are sans Duncan and we are sans time. Tell people how they can get in touch.
Well, you can follow us on Twitter. We're on @WiredUK. Nate is, of course, @NateLangson. Absent Duncan is @DuncanGear. I am Olivia_Solon. And Katie is @KatieScott1980.
That's the fellow. And you should go and be our Facebook friend because we've got loads of you now. Facebook.com/WiredUK. We've also got some competitions on there at the moment, so you should go over there and win some stuff. And you should email us, podcast@wired.co.uk, with any comments or more robot contraptions that try and sing with a pair of plastic lips. All welcome. And we will see you next week.
Bye. Not extendable. It does actually extend quite significantly when you add the milk.
Yeah, I've found that.